Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're going to have with us an exciting program tonight. We're going to have Joel Skousen with us. At least I hope we're going to have Joel Skousen. We seem to be having a little difficulty getting things lined up, but Joel is certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope he is one of yours as well. And we're going to be talking about the various items he covers in his World Affairs Brief. Joel has been with intelligence. He's been with the military in the years past, but now he writes an intelligence briefing trying to keep us abreast of what's going on around the world. And we're going to be talking a little bit about chemtrails tonight. We're going to be talking about all sorts of things, and we certainly hope that we'll give you an interesting overview. Joel certainly is very, very concerned about what's happening in the Middle East. He's concerned about what's happening to our economy, and everybody here should be as well. Our economy is in real trouble. The government is piling up massive debts, and there is no solution to the debts that we have. There's a $44 trillion abyss. If you add up all the debts, the pensions, the Social Security, the Medicare, all the things that the government has promised, there's no way that they can ever possibly pay it. And this is pretty obvious, but they don't want to admit it. Neither the Democrats or the Republicans want to admit what they've done. The Medicare bill that's just passed really is all about restricting access to health care for the seniors. At least the Democrats have it right. I don't know why the Republicans ever went with this. A boondoggle is supposed to cost $400 billion. Now, remember, we're running a deficit of the next year, probably $750 billion. And so they want to add on another $40 billion to that. In other words, we're going to spend money that we don't have. We're going to buy drugs for our senior citizens with the incomes of our children and our grandchildren in the future, because somebody's going to have to pay on this massive debt back that we're running up. And where is the outcry? Oh, we've got to do this. You know, we want to help the seniors. No, you want to restrict their access to health care. You want to get them out of the Medicare program that pays everything, and you know you can't afford, but you don't want to admit it. You want to put them into HMOs so that the HMO corporations will restrict their access to health care so the politicians won't get the blame for it. That's what it's really all about, because they know if they don't begin cutting back on the expense, why, the whole thing's going to collapse. Well, with that cheerful thought behind us, let's go to our special guest this evening, and his name is Joel Skousen. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Nice to be with you. And I guess we're going to do 2 hours together tonight.
Right, we're going to do a marathon. Well, there's just so much to cover, because you took a couple of weeks off, so there are a lot of things we haven't covered.
And that's so, right, I did.
So where are we going to start tonight?
Well, I put out during our absence a special report that's received a lot of notoriety, and I think your guests would enjoy it as well. It was put out on November 28th, and it was a backgrounder on U.S. and British war crimes in World War II. And I did this because President Bush insists on continuing to claim the moral high ground, using glowing generalizations, of course, wrapped in selected but deceptive truths and half-truths, claiming that he's only in Iraq to liberate a people. I note with interest that he's just now sealed the fate of Taiwan, declaring that he does not oppose any change in the status quo and warning Taiwan that they should never seek for a referendum on independence. So while other countries are supposedly liberated from mild dictators like Saddam Hussein, Taiwan is thrown back into the arms of the most ruthless dictator on the earth, China, with all of its millions of prisoners and in the Laogai or their prison system. And this is just hypocrisy in the extreme.
All right. Well, of course, we hear a lot of bad things about Saddam Hussein. We hear about these mass graves with hundreds of thousands of people, 100,000 in them. But, of course, a lot of those people were the Shia Muslims who believed George W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, and rose up back in 1941, 1991, when George Bush told them to rise up, that they'd rise up and overthrow Saddam or try. We'd come in and help them. And so they did rise up just like we asked them to. And then we let Saddam put his helicopter gunships in the air and go down and mow them down. And then they, with the military, Iraq military went in and they slaughtered. They probably killed 100,000. So this isn't to say that Saddam wasn't a wicked and evil individual, but remember, he was our man. We backed him all during the 1990s. And even after that, at least according to the book by Robert Baer, See No Evil, who was a CIA agent over in Iraq during the 1995, why the Iraq military repeatedly tried to overthrow Saddam, and we betrayed them each time. So there are a lot of unanswered questions. He's a wicked man, but he used to work for the CIA. Have you ever gone into that?
Oh, yes. Certainly the evidence is overwhelming that he was set up as a CIA agent to overthrow the regime back in 1956 and was put into power after an interim regime, and that's been no secret, of course, for some time. And as bad as 100,000 deaths are to God, and certainly these people will pay at the judgment bar of God, we're talking about millions in the dedicated communist countries of Russia and China during the purges, and these people are truly ruthless and are capable of making Saddam's forays into death, many of those of which, of course, were military combat, look like a piker compared to what the Chinese did, and the Russians, as real purges. I mean, we're talking about non-combat civilian deaths simply purged because they were critical of the regime, and we're talking millions, Stan. And unfortunately, what I gave in this background on U.S.-British war crimes is that the U.S. and British authorities actually participated in shipping millions of people back to their deaths into the death camps of Stalin at the end of World War II, and there's going to be hell to pay in heaven for those crimes. People who claim to be protecting democracy and making the world safe for democracy, even then. What I'm trying to establish is that the United States has always claimed the moral high ground, but they really have, it's only been rhetorical. These people have been involved, in my opinion, in a globalist conspiracy of very large proportions, and it's the only way to explain why they have in one side of the mouth proclaimed freedom and liberty for people and yet denied it to them, in fact engaged in some of the same exact tactics that we condemn the Nazis for in the Jewish Holocaust, Eisenhower did, with freedom-loving Russians who were trying to escape Poles and Ukrainians who are trying to escape Stalin's grasp.
Well, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about Operation Keel Haul? But, you know, this was one of the first things I ever heard of back in 1962, and I turned on the wrong radio program and listened to this old man talking about this concept of Operation Keel Haul. At the end of the Second World War, we sent back 6 million Russians who had either been captured by the Nazis or who'd gone over to the Nazis because their intense hatred to communism. And at the end of the war, Stalin demanded we send them all back so they could be punished and made examples of. And of course, FDR and Roosevelt, Roosevelt and I guess Roosevelt wasn't there at the time, it was probably Truman and
right.
Churchill went right along with that, sent those people back. And whether it was 6 million or 5,800,000, which is the figure that Tolstoy has in his book, The Secret Betrayal, it was an awful lot of people who didn't want to go back, who were rounded up and at bayonet point, sent back. Would you like to talk a little bit about it? There are 3 books out there written about it. We even have a video that came from Great Britain on this, but hardly any Americans have ever heard of Operation Keel Haul.
Well, actually, it's the most well-known of what I'm going to cover tonight in our 2 hours. There are 5 areas that I want to just review in advance so that your listeners will know what to expect here that I think indicate the full range of prosecution of or persecution of truth bearers and of liberty-loving peoples that is occurring even today against those of us who oppose this, you know, trumped-up war. Number one, I'm going to cover in the Roosevelt administration, like the Bush administration today, demonstrated the full range of ulterior globalist motives in its intent to take us into a world war. And I think what we're doing now overseas and in the Balkans and Muslim countries is a precursor to taking us into World War III. There's the Tyler Kent affair, which I'll cover, which was a U.S. cipher clerk in the London embassy who ended up, the American government, who ended up finding out all of the secret communication between Roosevelt and Churchill, planning to deceptively provoke incidents to get the U.S. into the war in opposition to the Neutrality Act, and how he was taken down, prosecuted, and put away for many years to silence the evidence that he had against this duplicity that was going on. Number two, I want to talk about the U.S. deliberately covering up the atrocities committed by Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin in the Kachin Forest affair, where over 15,000 Polish military officers and elite aristocrats and civilians were killed in the Smolensk, Russia region of the Kachin Forest. Number three, I'd like to cover the purposeful campaign of, began with Winston Churchill purposely bombing German civilians in order to provoke Hitler into retaliating against Britain. And I'll show through the evidence tonight that that was in fact the precursor to the bombing of London. And in fact, you know, traditional history says that Churchill and Roosevelt only began bombing German civilians after Hitler bombed British civilians, but this was not true. They actually provoked Hitler into bombing London in order to widen the war and bring the U.S. into it. Number four, we'll talk about Operation Keelhaul. And number five, a little known but even larger death count occurred directly at the hands of General Eisenhower in what's called the Other Losses Affair. It's a book that came out in 1991 revealing that the U.S. had a systematic program for creating a death camps for German prisoners, whereby they systematically starved them and exposed them to severe temperature and dysentery and disease by giving them absolutely no protection for over a year, putting them out in barbed wire enclosures in a field open to the weather and with no sanitary, no tent facilities, no tents. Extreme starvation and deprivation killed over a million German prisoners in contravention of the Geneva Convention. And this is something you probably hadn't heard about yet. It's only come forth recently in a book that came out in 1991. So that's the overview of where we'd like to go, if that's with your permission.
You go right ahead. I'll have to check with the boss, but the boss says it's okay. Go right ahead.
Well, let's go to the Tyler Kent affair first. As I said, this occurred in 1939 and 40, an obscure cipher clerk at the American Embassy, Tyler G. Kent. Now, this was no ordinary little private in the Army. This is a person who came from a highly educated background. His family were State Department employees who lived in all over Europe working for the State Department, had a significant time in Russia and Germany, so he was fluent in about four different languages. It's very natural then that he was, when he joined the military service, was put into the section for deciphering and working on coded messages. But Kent discovered that Churchill and Roosevelt were actively planning illegal activities contrary to the U.S. Neutrality Act designed to foment a Second World War and compel American involvement. Kent's testimony about his discoveries is important because most academics, eager to promulgate, as you know, the establishment view that Churchill and Roosevelt were heroes and patriots, concentrate a lot of the official archives of the State Department that have finally been opened up. What they don't realize, in quoting from the archives, which the public thinks, oh, they've got the inside story, they've got previously classified archives, which now prove that Roosevelt and Churchill really had a benevolent time trying to work together to save democracy. But in fact, they failed to realize that those archives were carefully sanitized and kept separate from the real secret communication seen by Kent. Obviously, few other key officials have also seen what Kent had seen, but were committed to keeping their oath of loyalty to the president.
Well, now, wasn't it this that basically Kent was decoding the messages, coded messages that Roosevelt was sending to Churchill? They were coming into the American embassy, and then he would turn them over to Churchill, and then Churchill would have him send coded messages back to Roosevelt. Wasn't that what it was all about?
Precisely. Okay. Precisely. Now, over a period of a year, Kent was making copies of these incriminating documents and taking them to his apartment with the goal of alerting sympathetic British and U.S. politicians who opposed the war. President Roosevelt claimed that he was going to campaign on keeping us out of war. He was not going to get us involved. At the very time he was making statements like that, reassuring the public that we want no part of this European war, he was sending messages to Churchill, designing ways in which they could provoke U.S. involvement.
I remember that, I hate war, Eleanor hates war, even little Fala, that was his dog, hates war. And, I pledge you no American boy will ever die on foreign, fighting on foreign soil again. That was his pledge to the American people in 1940, at the same time he was plotting on taking us into the war.
He was absolutely lying. This was an unprincipled conspirator in American politics that had no qualms about telling outright lies to the American people. And I'm going to quote some very interesting documents that have come out from David Irving's research in his book on Churchill, showing out of the archives out of Britain how they've actually got some quotes from Roosevelt telling Churchill that he's waiting to be able to provoke a war with both Germany and Japan.
Now, I think the interesting thing is apparently the British records become available in 50 years. The American records are never available, and to this very day, many of the documents surrounding what happened at Pearl Harbor are still classified or top secret.
Well, David Irving has made a good case for the fact, though, that even after the 50 years pass, which they have now, that the British archives are selectively still closed under certain secrets, just as the U.S. are. So they're just as much guilty of maintaining this the secret collusion between Roosevelt and Churchill. But enough has leaked out, and that's why David Irving's series, Churchill Volumes 1, 2, and 3, are dramatic. Now, and I'll get into some of his quotes later on, but what betrayed Kent was the fact that he began to work with Captain Archibald Ramsay, a member of Parliament, who was a staunch opponent of Churchill. But the British Secret Service had infiltrated Archibald Ramsay's office and was shadowing him and reporting anything that he was planning against Churchill to the Churchill government. So Kent was exposed, Anna Volkoff, a Russian refugee who was escaped communism, she ended up having some German contacts because of her opposition to communism, and you know, Germany was essentially making the only one of their propaganda pieces to the German people, justifying their warmongering was to oppose communism. And so people like Anna Volkoff, a legitimate Russian refugee, would have been drawn into some of these German contacts because of their attempts to fight communism. Unknown to Kent, though, the U.S. officials would use this relationship with Anna Volkoff to try to make the case that Kent was spying for Germany, which was not the case. In any case, what was interesting about the way in which Kent's case was handled is that he had a diplomatic passport. It would have been illegal for the British people to arrest him and put him through their judicial system. Do we need to take a break?
Got about 30 seconds, so all right. I'll just remind our listeners that our guest this evening is Joel Skousen from the World Affairs Brief, and we'll be covering the details of what's going on, the amazing case of Tyler Kent. And eventually Tyler Kent, many years later, was released, and of course his story has rarely been told to the American people, because of course it incriminates the American president lying to the American people. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Go ahead, Joel. We just pick up from here, and we will lose our listeners up in the Great Northwest for about 4 minutes. And then when we come back again, I will sort of recapitulate what you've said, and in about 20 seconds we'll go on. So pick up the story from there.
Okay. He talks about his background, which I think is very interesting, in Russia, living with his family, was in the secret, or in the U.S. Foreign Service. He said, "I took the opportunity to meet and mingle with ordinary Russian citizens in Moscow and learn firsthand the beastly nature of Bolshevism, realizing what it would mean if this barbarism were to spread further. My awareness grew also of the worldwide ideology of the so-called liberals who gushed over what they called the new civilization in the Soviet Union. I began to see dimly the power of propaganda in the United States." And essentially, here we have a constitutionalist emerging way back then who began to see the same battle that you and I have seen over the years about liberals promoting the communist and socialist agenda all in the name of detente, and he was against that. So he arrived, he said, in, and I'm quoting from his story, in London in September of 1939 to assume duties at the U.S. Embassy. "My duties included access to sensitive documents dealing with policy matters. Almost immediately I became aware that the clandestine activities of the Roosevelt administration were at variance with the public statements of its spokesmen, who, of course, as you just said, were claiming to be intent on keeping America out of war. This included Roosevelt himself and the lesser figures around him. It shall always be borne in mind at this time that there was no unanimity either in Congress or among the general public with regards to either passive or active participation of the United States in the European conflict. Opinion polls had, in fact, shown a huge majority opposed to such involvement." So he said that, and he talks interestingly about the same criticism that you and I have sometimes received from fellow conservatives about not being loyal to President Bush because we're critical in a time of war at his what appears to be ulterior motives. He said, and I quote, "Much of the vicious slander that has been directed against me over the years has centered around the allegation of disloyalty. The Department of State's press release in 1944 hammers away at this. Yet to whom and to what was my loyalty due? It was claimed that I was loyal to Ambassador Joseph B. Kennedy and to President Roosevelt. Under most circumstances, I would agree. But a government employee takes an oath to support the laws and the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, both foreign and domestic." Now, I interject here to say this is a key point of intent that sets Kent apart from other accused spies. Going back, he says, "Events have now proven that as regards to the damage done to the interests of this country, no foreign enemy could have done more than Roosevelt himself. He was the greatest domestic enemy, and no subordinate owed him any loyalty whatsoever in the furtherance of his illegal activities." Now, that's a powerful statement, Dr. Stan.
We remember there was a Lindbergh at the time, Charles Lindbergh, had said that American boys going overseas to fight for freedom will, of course, find that they've lost liberty here at home. And Lindbergh didn't want us to get into that war in Europe. And, of course, he was equated with being, pro-fascist and loving Hitler. And that anybody who opposed going to war was on the other side. Like the people who didn't want to go to war with Saddam Hussein were supposedly pro-Saddam. Not at all. But I really wonder if we're going to make America safer by going over to Iraq and wasting countless hundreds of billions of dollars. We'll be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. Well, Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Joel Skousen of World Affairs, briefly, we've been talking about Tyler Kent, who was the code clerk who worked in Ambassador Kennedy's office in London in the years leading up to the Second World War, who actually was the man who decoded the messages that FDR, President Roosevelt, sent to Churchill, and Churchill's messages back to FDR, where they were planning on bringing America into the war for several years before the onset of hostilities when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. But basically, they were looking for an excuse to get us into the war. And this would even, you might say, well, gee, we had to stop Adolf Hitler. Well, if you read some of the books we have, how American corporations were financing Adolf Hitler, how American banks were financing Adolf Hitler, how even the Bush family was financing Adolf Hitler, not only before the war, but all during the war as well. But we can't let the American people know that this was simply another contrived war, because 50 million people died. So anyway, Tyler Kent is the code clerk. He's caught by the British intelligence. He has these messages, and so they're going to come up with trumped-up charges to make him look like a German spy. Now, ordinarily, the British can't touch him because he has diplomatic immunity. The only thing they could do was send him home, but if he came home, he might tell the truth, and he might let the American people know what he knew. So he's sent off to prison. How long was he in prison? Do we have any idea?
Yes, about 8 years.
All right, then eventually he gets loose, released. He comes back to the United States. Does he ever get a chance to tell his story, or is he always under that cloud of being a traitor, being pro-Nazi?
Yeah, he was very much persecuted by, and the media refused to tell his side of the story, and there was a real collusion in the media at that time, and so he really got apathetic for many years. It wasn't really until the 90s that he told the story again, and that's how we know about it. But interesting enough, you know, Kent, as you said, was arrested in a goon squad type attack, busting down the door with military intelligence present and also an official of the U.S. Embassy, giving assent to this refusal to honor his diplomatic passport. You said it exactly correctly. They did not want him going back to the United States where he'd be free to tell his story. They wanted him sent to prison in a secret British court. Now, this was also against British legal and judicial protocols at the time. He was arrested along with a member of Parliament, Archibald Ramsey, who had been shown some of these documents. They had to silence him as well. The trial had to be held in absolute secrecy due to the embarrassing nature of the documents in Kent's possession. Even though they had captured the documents, that's the first thing they did when they went in through the, busted through the door. They ransacked the house looking until they found the suitcase where he had these documents in his possession. British prosecutors informed Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy, who was JFK's father, that, quote, the documents in question would certainly be produced only behind locked doors in a cleared court. The press would be ordered not to publish their contents. In fact, no pressman would be present, they assured him. As Kent himself observed, what was it that they dared not discuss in public? That is really the crux of the case. The real reason why I was tried and sentenced to a prison term in England and not tried in the United States is clear from the statement of the British authorities made to Joseph Kennedy. There you have it in a nutshell. The British, like the Bolsheviks, still have secret trials. Indeed, they still do, as we know, in the name of fighting terror. So this is not new, even though we did retain a fair amount of our freedoms, or get them back, after all of the draconian regulations and controls of World War II. They knew, I think, that the American people were not ready to succumb to those permanently. But I'm afraid the freedoms that we've lost in the Patriot Act and other things under this phony war of terrorism are permanent losses, mostly because we have diehard, the appearance of diehard conservatives adamantly defending the Patriot Act.
I'm really very concerned to find Justice Bork defends the Patriot Act, John Ashcroft defends the Patriot Act, and we're told without the Patriot Act, how could we possibly defend you? Without taking away the rights of people to a trial by jury, or without being able to do away with, your right to be free from search, without being able to secretly search your home, without you even knowing about it, why? How could we fight terrorism? And then they turn around and they use all these laws in the Patriot Act on people that not even the most remote connection with terrorism. And then when you say, well, but you said this was about terrorism, they said, well, after all, we have to get the bad guys, and you wouldn't expect us to use these wonderful laws now that they're in place. After all, we're here to protect you. We're from the government. So we're going to use the anti-terrorist laws on people who are not terrorists, because, of course, they're guilty, and that we're going to prove they're guilty by using all these laws that are designed to circumvent the Constitution. Well, I think everybody should be concerned about what's going on. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. And hold your calls for the time being. I think we want to hear as much of this as we possibly can right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will give serious consideration to helping us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day by radio and shortwave, by satellite, by internet, trying to get people to understand what's going on. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARN. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, first we'd be glad to send you one. Our latest newsletter, the December newsletter, will be available probably in a week to 10 days. It's an amazing story of the saga of Judge Roy Moore. And we go into the background of course, the trial that was held. It was really almost like the trial of Tyler Kent, where there were no television cameras allowed. Nobody was allowed to record what was said. They didn't want the people to know what happened. But, of course, they televised the verdict when they did away with Judge Roy Moore. But, of course, we will tell you why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. What is the real reason? Everybody knows the Supreme Court took God out of our schools, but why did they do that when even the Supreme Court opens with the phrase, the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court? They do essentially the same thing in the state of Alabama, where they say, God save the state and this honorable court. So why did the, what is this Judge Roy Moore all about? Well, we will go ahead and tell you here in when we get get our newsletter. That's the December newsletter. If you'd like to get a copy, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, we also hope that you'll go to our website, which is RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And there you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day, either on Radio Liberty or on the American Freedom Network or on the Genesis Network. You can hear this program on the internet. It'll be archived there, as will our next program, the rest of this hour's program. Please tell others about our website. Please tell them about our ministry. Encourage them to listen to our radio programs and perhaps even join the Radio Liberty family. In fact, if every person listening to the program could recruit one person into the Radio Liberty family, why, we'd have this program on shortwave, the evening program. Now, as you know, we do 2 hours shortwave a day. Our goal is to do 4 hours of shortwave, and with the internet and the shortwave, at least we can reach the people who want to know there's a problem, and then, of course, we go ahead and we buy time on regular stations to get people who don't even know there's a problem. Give us a call at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan here. Our special guest this evening is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. And before we forget, Joel, let's get your telephone number and your website out there so people can get copies of your World Affairs Brief and perhaps even want to subscribe to it as I do.
Thank you, Stan. The World Affairs Brief is a weekly news analysis service I put out by subscription. It's a very modest price for a weekly news analysis. You can read about it at my website, joelskousen.com. That's spelled as one word, J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N, joelskousen.com. And you can read about the World Affairs Brief, my section on law and government, and the various books I've written there on the website. And soon I'd like to announce is that I'm going to be putting on a good deal of the raw briefs that I get from my sources and links to things that you can get a daily news update, such as the Matt Drudge, only this will be from a real constitutional conservative point of view. And that should be interesting and allow people to have access to a lot more current finds that my sources put out to me each day. I get about 100 emails with significant pieces of information that I analyze. Now, if people don't have access to the web, and I encourage you to do that sometime in the future if you don't, but if you don't have access and want a printed edition sample of the World Affairs Brief, you can call my office during working hours, area code 801-224-4746. And I'll be happy to send out samples of the print edition of the World Affairs Brief.
Give that telephone number one more time.
Area code 801-224-4746.
All right, that's 801-224-4746 or joelskousen.com. Well, pick up the story there. We were talking about Tyler Kent and the fact he was in imprisoned, and he was imprisoned really because of the collusion of the British and the American governments, because they didn't want the American people to know the truth. And the same sort of thing has gone on many times since then, but this is such a well-documented case, and the fact most people have never heard of Tyler Kent is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think.
This poor man should be given the Medal of Honor because he was a truly principled conservative, recognizing his higher oath and allegiance to the Constitution than to the President of the United States. He was privy to a recognizable pattern of lies and conspiracy in a secret combination between Roosevelt and other powers that be in England. Now, this is significant because, people still refuse to believe that there is evidence of conspiracy, and that's much to be said because people who have first-hand evidence like Tyler Kent, their lives have been destroyed. Now, obviously, the information he was gathering was indeed a threat to the powers that be, a threat to President Roosevelt and his integrity. It could have been used had it fallen into Hitler's hand. Hitler would have certainly made hay showing that Roosevelt and Churchill were inciting, him to action and would have made cast dispersions, of course, on the integrity of Roosevelt. So Kent had to be silenced. In my opinion, as I said, I think he deserves a medal rather than certainly to be reprieved from the prison time that he served. Now, while we don't have access to the secret documents collected by Kent, and he has been threatened to this day not to speak of what he actually saw other than the generalities that he has done, there are other evidence of Roosevelt's eagerness to get the U.S. into war. This comes from David Irving's Churchill's Volume 2, page 38. On that day, Churchill briefed his top people on the commitments he had extracted from Roosevelt as they held a summit on the battleship USS Augusta in Placentia Bay, Newfoundland, Canada. According to the diary of Vice Chief of Britain's Chief of Staff, said Roosevelt is all for coming into the war as soon as possible, but he said he would never declare war. He wishes to provoke it first. I repeat, Roosevelt said he doesn't wish to declare war. He wishes to first provoke it. The American plan, according to Churchill, was to create an incident that brings the war about. Now, this is real live evidence of conspiracy. This is pure Hegelian dialectic evil. Another aide to Churchill, Sir Alexander Cadogan, head of the Foreign Office, said in his diary that the Roosevelt's upcoming ultimatum to Japan, yet to be drafted, would produce another situation which may lead to war between Japan and the U.S. We now know from the declassified messages published in Robert Stinnett's Day of Deceit blockbuster book that Roosevelt had in fact crafted a six-point plan to provoke Japan into attacking the U.S. And so there's a great deal of evidence if you can put all the pictures together.
Well, we carry the book Day of Deceit. We also have interviews that we have a four-tape set on Pearl Harbor with 2 hours with Robert Stinnett. But, of course, one of my most treasured possessions is the pages from Secretary of War Stimson's diary I found back at the Sterling Library at Yale University. And there he talks about a meeting on November 25th with President Roosevelt, where Roosevelt said, "We'll probably be attacked next Monday. We expect a surprise attack from the Japanese. The only question is how we can get into the war, get the Japanese to fire the first shot, and have as little damage to ourselves as possible." So they left those boys at Pearl Harbor to die. And those of you who saw the picture of Pearl Harbor, it came out fairly recently, maybe about 3 years ago, you remember that after the attack was well underway, here comes a boy on a bicycle, delivering a Western Union message to Admiral Kimmel. The Japanese are about to attack Pearl Harbor. So,
pure lies.
Right.
Well, the next subject is the Captain Forrest affair. And what makes this significant is two things. Not that the Russians acted in any way that we know that they've acted. I mean, they killed probably 60 million people totally in Russia in the purges, and so 15,000 Polish military and other important aristocrats and the elite of Poland, is but a drop in the bucket. The Germans, even in their purging of Jews and others from Poland, didn't exceed that number. But nevertheless, it's important for another aspect. We learn a tremendous lesson from one of the main sources that I quote here for this book. By the way, I document all that we're talking about tonight in this November 28th briefing, this backgrounder on U.S.-British war crimes in World War II. If any of your listeners want an actual copy of the briefing, have them email me at joel@joelskousen.com, and I'll be happy to send them by email a copy of this entire brief where you can read the sources and the actual quotes that I have. But there is a book by a Polish survivor of the, who was originally supposed to be part of the 15,000 Polish military that were killed there, but somehow escaped that and researched all of this with his fellow Polish people who didn't, who evaded that, and came up with a very interesting story about, first of all, how the Russians deceived the Polish army into a good portion of the 15,000 came from the Polish army that submitted to the Russians at Lvov, Poland, under where Field Marshal Tymoshenko had promised the Polish General Langner safe passage for all his officers and soldiers if they would not fight and save the Russians from having to conquer and destroy the whole city. Langner was convinced that he was going to be allowed with his men to return to their homes in Poland, and yet all of their soldiers were then rounded up and put in temporary encampments right as they left the city and were headed home. Langner protests this and was assured in the most agreeable manner by Marshal Tymoshenko that this was just a temporary thing because they couldn't allow the prisoners to go and disrupt the countryside if they all went back in one fell swoop. And the story is interesting because as the Russians began lying to them in a way that is almost impossible to counteract. I mean, you go up and protest something, and the general agrees with everything you say. What do you say after that? Do you accuse him of lying? No, you have to wait and see if the word comes true, and finally it doesn't come true, and then he appeals to Stalin, and he spends a year going from place to place in Russia and getting the same story, complete, absolute assurances that the Russians will comply with every letter of the agreement signed with Tymoshenko, until it finally ends up that he hears about the killings in Katyn Forest almost 6 months after they've happened, and the Russians are still assuring them that these people are alive and well somewhere in the world, but we don't know where they are. It's just an incredible story of Western naivete in believing the big lie, and the bigger the lie. Of course, they controlled his movements so that he wasn't able to check out the Russian assurances that these things were true. But isn't that sad, Dr. Stan, that they take advantage of the benevolence of the Western Christian mind to get them to delay action until it's too late? Same thing happened with the Jewish prisoners going into the camps that were told lies about why they were boarding trains, that they were going to have work there and eventually get freedom.
Yeah,
very sad.
Big sign over the camp entrance to the camp in Auschwitz, you know, work sets you free. Arbeiten, I forgot an exact German phrase.
Macht frei, right.
Work makes you free, and of course you walked into the camp and then they put you in for the showers. And but you're dealing with organized evil, and this is the thing that it's so difficult for the average American to believe. But of course we can see just glimpses of this today as the administration does everything they can to block the investigating committees of what really happened on September 11th. If there's nothing to hide, if they had no prior knowledge, why are they concealing all of this information from Osama bin Laden?
And the pattern is true, even with the Katyn Forest affair. I mean, this should have been something that was readily available to the American people. But interestingly enough, it was discovered, the massacres were discovered by
the Poles, weren't they?
Actually, the Polish and German were, not German, Polish and German Freiarbeit, the free workers, they were basically people who agreed to go work for the Germans as kind of slave laborers in order to work out their freedom, and they had uncovered these prisoners, and the Russians immediately blamed it on the Germans.
Yeah.
And the Germans knew that they hadn't done it. In fact, the Russian prisoners who lived from the area said, oh yeah, we know that the Russians did this. They had a dacha here for all the NKVD Cheka people who were the killers, and they had parties, and we had to attend them, and they would brag about how many people that they had killed in the Russian Revolution, or the White Russians, etc. So this had been a killing field for a long time, and the Russian people who worked there in the area knew about that. But the Germans decided to mount an international inquiry into that, and interesting enough, the Roosevelt administration refused to participate in solidarity with the Russians. And so the Germans wisely went to the prison camps and got some American officers and forced them to go and attend the international investigation so that they could be American witnesses of that. Now, one of the officers, a Lieutenant Colonel Van Fleet, came there very reluctantly. He had been forced to do this. He was very skeptical. He thought this was another German propaganda thing, and so he was prejudiced against the German point of view. But as he saw the doctors going through the autopsies and noting the various things that they noticed, he also noticed that after seeing hundreds of these corpses unearthed, that the boots and shoes from these Polish soldiers and officers were almost in new condition. Now, the Germans had not come in until almost a year and a half after this death had occurred. And had this been done by the Germans, the Polish officers, since the war began, had had their boots for almost a couple of years, they would have been almost worn out. But they were in new conditions, uniform with thousands of them. So he came independently to the conclusion the Russians had to have done it because of such evidence as the condition of the shoes of these people.
But they were our allies. We were giving them massive amounts of money and equipment and doing everything we could to help the Russians. And even after the war, why we gave them even copies of our currency, occupation currency plates, so that they could print American occupation currency money that we would redeem, so they'd have the money to occupy Eastern Europe. People don't understand that we did everything we could to help the Russians and did everything we could to play down their horrible atrocities. And to this very day, if you talk about the 60 million people that were killed in Russia, why you're immediately demonized and attacked and you're an extremist and you believe in black helicopters and the whole litany of information that's used or adjectives that's used to make you appear to be a radical right-wing fanatic, some sort of a nut.
Well, one could make the case that the U.S. didn't know of Stalin's evil intentions until after the war played out. But what's interesting here is that Van Fleet, his experience and what happened in the cover-up occurred after the war when Stalin's intentions were well known. We know now that Stalin kept behind approximately 5,000 British and American soldiers in his prison camps to make sure that the U.S. complied with the Yalta giveaway of Eastern Europe. And even after the U.S. complied with Operation Keelhaul, returning all of these nearly a million people to the arms of Stalin after the war, and many other things that they did, they continued to cover up for Stalin's, they gave Pulitzer Prizes to Times columnists who had falsified the death camps of Stalin made it all go away in the Ukrainian purges.
That's right.
And, of course, now only, now there is a movement to remove his Pulitzer Prize, and whether or not that will happen, I don't know.
I don't think it's going to. I think they've decided to let them keep it after all of us a long time ago, and it would be so embarrassing to admit that the New York Times had intentionally lied to the people. But, yeah. The figures, whether it was 5,000 or 25,000 American soldiers were kept back. We have some documents that says 20, 25,000, but those boys were never returned, were they?
No, never returned, and the U.S. never protested it.
And our leaders knew that they'd abandoned all those boys
die
in Siberia. And they kept lying to their families and saying, oh, we can't talk about that. Why you're going to, if you were to say anything, you were to make it public, why this would interfere with our chances we can get them back. And they never wanted to get them back. They never intended to bring them back.
But interesting, Van Fleet, as soon as the war was over, he went to the Eisenhower Chafe headquarters with his report, which he had written down about Russian guilt in this Kachin Forest affair. Immediately, Chafe headquarters recognized this was a politically hot potato, and they sent him to Washington, D.C., where he was specifically told to talk to General Clayton Bissell. Bissell was apparently the key cover-up man and slapped a top-secret classification on it, swore Van Fleet to secrecy that he was never to reveal his observation to anyone ever again during his entire life. Then the report disappeared. Bissell would not have acted so quickly, of course, and forcefully in this manner had he not been privy to an American political agenda to cover up for the evils of Soviet Russia.
And I think it's so important to realize that one of the top communist agents operating in the United States at that time was living in the White House. His name was Harry Hopkins. That came out in the Verona Files. This was the closest advisor to the President of the United States at that time.
Yes. Now, interesting enough, Congress did begin an investigation under Ray J. Madden. He was assigned to hold hearings on the Katyn Forest cover-up by the State Department. And he summoned General Bissell before his committee. Bissell claimed that the Van Fleet report was nowhere to be found and that he couldn't remember its contents. You know, highly unbelievable that he couldn't remember contents, that it was so sensitive that he slapped a top-secret order on it and swore him to secrecy. The committee then contacted Colonel Van Fleet by that time and relieved him of his oath of secrecy on the matter, and Van Fleet faithfully told what he knew to Congress from memory, and the contents, of course, of his report are not as telling as the fact that the U.S. suppressed it ruthlessly. So in any case, now even additional evidence we have from the archives of the Russians as well as the Venona intercepts. We have a memorandum from NKVD letterhead from El Beria, head of the Russian Secret Service, to Stalin, talking about his intent to execute by shooting thousands of Polish officers, soldiers, and other prisoners in the Smolensk, Russia area. This is a document of Katyn Forest. Stalin's handwriting is on the top of the incriminating document. Politburo members' signatures, Voroshilov, Molotov, Mikoyan, Kalinin, and Kaganovich are also on this, indicating the entire Soviet hierarchy had signed on to the plan. The U.S. had this document for all these years. Yeah. Not only did they suppress Van Fleet's thing, they had absolute evidence that the top hierarchy had knowingly killed these Polish officers, and it continued to cover for it. Source on this is Thaddeus Whitland, a poll entitled Time Stopped at 6:30. That's when the watches stopped of these people being massacred in the Katyn Forest. Published by Bobbs Merrill in 1965. Next subject, British bombing of civilians. This is a blockbuster one which very few people know about. They know about, some people, especially conservatives, know about Operation Keelhaul. They don't know what I'm going to talk about now. This is very important. Churchill's Codebreakers at Bletchley Park. PBS has run a real series on how they had broken the German code and the Russian code. They knew, first of all, that London and all civilian targets had been declared streng verboten, that means strictly forbidden by Hitler. And Churchill even knew that Hitler wasn't even going to invade Britain, though he pretended publicly that Britain was always in danger of imminent invasion. So, according to David Irving's exhaustive research in Churchill Volume 1, Churchill had been looking for a pretense to induce Hitler to bomb London, both one for a legitimate military purpose. The Luftwaffe was really taking down the number of British fighters in the Battle of Britain. It was a war of attrition. Germany had 10 times more fighters. They could afford to suffer more losses. Britain would be out of fighters if Churchill couldn't get Hitler to divert their attacks from the military targets to civilian targets. And that's one of the reasons why he went after civilians. But the other reason was, of course, to make Hitler out to be more of a criminal than he was initially, and to induce American sympathy to bring them into the war. And he and Churchill apparently discussed this strategy on the telephone of getting Hitler to bomb English civilians. Irving found such evidence in Charles de Gaulle's diary, where he said, on August 4th, de Gaulle found the Prime Minister on the lawn at Chequers. Chequers, that's Winston's suburban London retreat, shaking his fist at the sky and shouting in a strange fury, "So they won't come, so they won't come, well, I'll fix that." And, you know, de Gaulle saw this interesting show of a man, wanting, more war and to bomb innocent civilians. Churchill finally got an excuse when one of Germany's bombers overshot his target. The targets were the London docks, and a stick of bombs landed in the workers' district in East London's East End. No one was killed, but the resulting fires destroyed about 100 of those ramshackled homes. So Churchill finally had his incident. to justify retaliation and induce the bombing of London. So, in Churchill's Ultra briefings, Ultra is the code name for the German secret messages, he knew that the attack on the civilian homes was unintentional, and yet he ordered the immediately retaliatory air attacks on Berlin's residential districts in Germany. And it was only after four successive days of bombings of German civilians that Hitler issued the order to change the targeting to the city of London. So there we have it, direct evidence that Hitler worked to induce Hitler to bomb London so that he could widen the war and bring America into it for propaganda purposes. Now it even gets worse after that, Dr. Stan. We find now evidence from the archives that have been opened after 50 years in Britain that Sir Charles Porter and later Arthur Bomber Harris, the two air marshals in Britain, were devising ways to destroy whole cities by a combination of incendiary bombs and percussion bombs, staged in time so that they could kill the firefighters who were attacking the fires and then create huge firestorms, and they designed special bombing procedures to create these firestorms that would rampage through the city and do much more damage than the bombs themselves. And this we know happened in spades. There is it wasn't just Dresden, there were tens of cities. In a dramatic new book published in Germany by Jörg Friedrich called Beyond Slaughter, Memories of 45, he talks about the bombing of Baghdad cannot be compared to the Allies' incineration of German cities in World War II. And he talks about the systematic bombing of Schweinmunde, and where it was crammed with refugees from Eastern Germany and Russia who were fleeing the Soviet onslaught. They were bombed mercilessly, sprayed with machine gun fire from American and British dive bombers. I mean, it killed 25,000 civilians.
But they were targeting civilians. They were not targeting the military. That's what's so unconscionable.
And filled with refugees. I mean, and they knew they were filled with refugees. I mean, how much more terrible can you get?
Well, it said that they lost far more in Dresden over that two-day period than were killed in either Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
45,000 people killed in Hamburg during the air attacks. 50,000 in Dresden, 12,000 in Berlin, 10,000 in Kassel, 5,000 in Frankfurt, and so in four time of 63,000, one-third of the population was incinerated in one night in February of 1945. You know what the total death toll was to German to civilian bombing by U.S. and American forces? 5 to 6 million people. That equals the Jewish Holocaust. And it wasn't necessary. I mean, they were still losing the war tremendously. Germany was completely defeated. And the U.S. would not accept their general's attempt to surrender to the Americans. They wanted unconditional destruction of Germany, and that's why most of this occurred in 1945, totally unnecessary to kill all of these civilians at the end of the war.
Oh, we're just going to have to interrupt here for just a minute because we're going to have to let our listeners up in the Great Northwest go. But so I just want to say, please pray for America. We are involved in a spiritual battle. What you're seeing is the manifestation of something very, very evil. And believe me, it was here during the Second World War. It is still here today. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be back with you again. This is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for Radio Liberty, pray for our provision and protection, and we'll be with you again tomorrow. stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls ordinarily at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or at 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us our good friend Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're talking about six atrocities during the Second World War, and we've been talking about the civilian bombing by American bombers during the Second World War in Europe. And what you must understand is the German generals kept trying to surrender, and we would not accept their surrender or even discuss it unless it was an unconditional surrender. And, of course, the one thing they feared was Russian occupation of their country. That was the one thing that they could not accede to. Same thing was happening in Japan. The Japanese had tried to surrender for about 5 months before. They tried seven times to surrender in 5 months. And, of course, the invasion of Iwo Jima, the invasion of Okinawa, the dropping of the two bombs were totally unnecessary. But, you see, we would not allow them to surrender. And you have to ask yourself why. What possible motivation would there be to prolong this horrible, bloody war where a million people were dying every month? Why would any rational individual do that? And the answer is, we're not really dealing with rational people or people who have the same sense of values of human compassion as you and I would. So pick up the story there, Joel.
Well, interestingly enough, the British were tasking their bombers to bomb German civilians ever since 1941. The Americans didn't get into the act until 1944, beginning with Dresden, interestingly. They were set to be the third wave coming into Dresden to bomb, and they were using air controllers at the time in aircraft circling the city that were directing bombers of where to drop their bombs. And when the American crews got on target, they saw, of course, the industrial and city center that was in the flames, and they noted all the dark areas around there, which they knew would be residential districts. And they were very shocked when the airborne controller told them to unload their bombs on the darkened areas. Some of the lead pilots protested and said, but those are civilian areas. And he said, you are to dump your bombs on the darkened areas. Now, the U.S. Air Force commanders had to deal with not a few outraged pilots when they returned home from that first mission in Dresden. Pilots resistant to further bombing of civilian targets were reminded about the need to follow orders without question. This is very sad when military people are coerced with this follow orders. I mean, interestingly enough, we prosecuted Germans for war crimes in World War II, and we did not allow the defense that they were just following orders, but no one prosecuted American and British soldiers for bombing civilian population. At least 1.5 million bombs were dropped on 161 German cities and 800 villages over 5 years, leaving 500,000 civilians dead, including 75,000 children. And an additional 78,000 of Hitler's slave workers and prisoners of war were killed. And no one was ever punished for these acts. Of course, the winners did not include themselves in indictments for war crimes at Nuremberg. Now, interestingly enough, some people would not relent, American pilots, and they were reassigned. Most of them got used to the idea of bombing civilians after being given the justification that the German people were responsible for supporting Hitler. Now, I contend that people who are denied the political power to overthrow a government, remember Hitler had absolute power, he had a Gestapo, there was much opposition to his rising, he gained power because of the resentment of Germany over the very stiff penalties that were being paid and at the Versailles Treaty after World War One, and there was a dedicated propaganda machine that was systematically omitting essential truths that would lead people to disbelieve what Hitler was saying. And I submit that there's much parallel between the systematic omitting of truths to the American people in support of the Bush globalist agenda in Iraq that is comparable to what happened in Germany. Are Americans to be held fully responsible for war crimes of our leaders that are only now being brought fully to light? Well, those who knew back then are responsible, but most Americans were kept ignorant, just as the German people were. And tragically, you know, once military personnel cross a certain moral threshold and rationalize away the evil that they're commanded to perform, they become rather dumbed-down participants in genocide. And that's what I think happened to German soldiers guarding the death camps. It also happened to thousands of U.S. pilots and their commanders who knowingly bombed civilian targets. They just said, well, this is war. And it's very unfortunate, because when they will see in the judgment day someday the horror that they reaped and realize that they could have stopped it by refusing to follow orders, even if it meant a jail term, they would have been better off in their soul, I think.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with you. I think that when we realize the horror of what happened during that last 2 years of the war, and it was all unnecessary.
Well, even worse now, we come to Operation Keel Haul and then Operation Other Losses. The prime source of this U.S.-led travesty is Julius Epstein's Operation Keel Haul, the story of forced repatriation. Now, you said there are two other sources on that. Do you happen to know any?
Yes, one of them is called The East Came West. The other is called The Secret Betrayal by Tolstoy. It was Count Tolstoy's nephew, and we have both of the books in our library. We even have a video on Operation Keel Haul, a BBC documentary that was only allowed to be shown one time in America. And if you'd like, I can remind me. I'll be glad to send you a copy of that.
I would like that very much, Dr. Stan.
I'll tell you, it's one of the most... It's disheartening, because you hear these British soldiers who were there, and they're telling the BBC that's producing this commentary, they're breaking down and weeping because of what they've done.
Yes, I can see. You know, one of the interesting things, or the horrible things, you know, Operation Keel is still classified to this day because of the great horrors that they perpetrated upon American and British soldiers who had to enforce this operation. And this wasn't just waving a bayonet at them to go to get them into the trucks. They actually had to shoot people, and they shot people. They killed people escaping for their lives to keep from having to go back. And that gives people nightmares, knowing that they shot innocent people. They had numerous people committing suicide, trying to slit their wrists and trying to hang themselves. That's how desperate this operation was. And it was even worse in the sense that in Julius Epstein's book, Operation Keel Haul, he documents the cases of hundreds of thousands of ethnic Eastern Europeans who had escaped Russia and Stalin out of the Ukraine and out of Poland and other areas, Belarus. Even before, this was at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, so they had never been Soviet citizens. These people were rounded up as well and given back to Stalin, even though they had escaped the Bolshevik Revolution and had never been under communism before. They were rounded up and forced back into Stalin's hands. In addition, there were anti-communist soldiers under Russian General Vlasov who defected to the Germans in the hopes of freeing Russia from Stalin's grasp. Now, this was a Russian war hero. He was the general in charge of saving Moscow from the Germans. He later got captured by the Germans when he went north in the Battle of
Stalingrad.
In Stalingrad, he was sent out and got trapped in a pocket, and his entire army was then abandoned by Stalin. He was allowed to be captured. He was so irate about the abandonment by Stalin that he decided to fight against Stalin and rid Russia of the communist menace one and for all. He never became a Nazi. He did... soldiers were forced to don German uniforms, of course, so they wouldn't be mistaken for Russian soldiers in the front. And they fought against Russia, especially in southern Ukraine, trying to free them. And but at the end of the war, when they saw that the Germans were losing, they headed west trying to give themselves up to the Americans. Under General Eisenhower, in consultation with the State Department, a local officer had agreed to take Vlasov's men and give them asylum, but General Eisenhower and Marshall went back on their word of honor. Headquarters refused to designate them POWs or give them asylum, and eventually turned them back over to the Russians. All of their military leaders, these great heroes, were shot or hanged. The rest went to Soviet labor camps. some committed suicide before falling into Russian fate. And there was another story that was just horrendous in Epstein's book on Operation Keelhaul, in the fact that one of the groups of, this was General Shakuro and his Ukrainian Cossack troops, who were anti-Bolsheviks, they had immigrated after World War One, had never been a Soviet citizen. They fought on the side of Germany to try to liberate Russia. They demanded political asylum, and the British confiscated all their Western currency, held them in detention. They were told on May 28, 1945, that all officers and enlisted men were to attend a special conference with higher British authorities and would be transported by truck. Now, this seemed implausible. Why transport thousands of prisoners when the British officers could come to them? So they suspected, of course, a trap. An English lieutenant and then later on a major both assured them on their word of honor as British officers that you were just going to a conference. Another British officer, of course, even higher up, gave the same assurance. The convoy was guarded, which did nothing to alleviate the Cossacks' anxiety. A few jumped from the trucks and escaped into the forest. Those were the smart ones, those that trusted the British and ended up driving into a prisoner of war camp at Spital, Austria, in the Russian sector of control. The British officer then informed them all that in accordance with an agreement concluded between the military authorities in the United Kingdom and the Soviet Union, all officers would be put at the disposal of Soviet military authorities. A Cossack general asked the officer when the agreement was signed, and he replied on May 23rd of this year, 1945. So there it was. 2 days earlier, he knew about this agreement and gave his word of honor that they were not ever going to be turned over to the Soviets. They literally just lied to them on their word of honor. And what was interesting, when they were finally being interrogated before they turned them over to the Russians, somehow they had them take some, ask them if they've ever been, I'm trying to remember what the exact words for it, but if they've ever given their word you know, falsely or something, and it said, no, only when a British officer assured us of the, on their word of honor or something. It was a very poignant telling of the fact that I've never, ever been betrayed by the Russians as bad as I was betrayed by the Soviets.
By the British.
Isn't that a sad commentary? Remember that all of these people, German soldiers included, had been desperate to get to American lines to surrender. And then, and these Russian people and all of these refugees had been desperate to get to American lines, and then Operation Keelhaul sent them back to Russia. And worst of all, this last example called Other Losses, a new book by James Bach, actually in 1991, hasn't got any press, but it's still out there. You can find it at Amazon.com, Prima Publishing, 1991. It's the story of a huge war crime, where the United States, under General Eisenhower, dictated a very top-secret series of orders. There was no operation given to it, like Keelhaul. It was so secret that it was only in verbal orders, but supply officers throughout the European theater told were to systematically deny German prisoners in five or six major camps, almost a million prisoners total. They were being kept, by the way, in prisons so that they could be used as forced labor to help rebuild Europe. That's why they weren't repatriated to Germany right after the war. But during the time, Eisenhower literally tried to kill as many as possible by systematically denying them any housing, even though there were piles of tents available to give them tents to sleep in during the winter time. They were given no sanitary facilities. These people lived in pits and holes to keep out of the wind, had to defecate in those pits and live among that. So it was just like what happened in the German prisoners or work camps to Jews. It was mostly not gas ovens that killed. 90% of them were killed by typhus and smallpox and other fevers and viruses that went through and ravaged these camps because of the unsanitary conditions and the poor nutrition. And this is exactly how Eisenhower killed a great many prisoners, almost a million German prisoners, saying I was going to treat them roughly and assuring Stalin that he was going to show no mercy to these people after they were captured. So I've lost a great deal of respect for Eisenhower after learning about his supervising Operation Keelhaul and the other losses incidents, which are even more heinous because the United States was a signer of the Geneva Convention.
Well, unfortunately, we are dealing with very, very evil and wicked people, and we have a copy of that book as well, and it's a devastating, devastating book.
Yes, it really is, because just as in the documentary about Operation Keelhaul, people realized after the fact, I couldn't understand why we kept giving these orders to reduce rations to the prisoners. We thought initially they would say that it was because there was so much starvation. He said, but I had mountains of food there. And we never did use it all. A lot of it went to waste, they said, but we were systematically told no tents for the German prisoners, no rations, no sanitary, and no medical care. It was just horrendous. This was as bad a Holocaust as the Germans perpetrated on the Jews.
You know, war brings out the worst in everybody, and we hear the story of Andersonville during the Civil War where, the gross mistreatment of the soldiers in there, and then thousands of them died as well. And here were Americans doing the same thing to Americans, probably not as bad as happened to the Germans, where they lost a million of those camps. But, we all come from a common Christian heritage, at least you would think we would. And yet, of course, good people follow orders and do commit terrible atrocities because they're simply doing what they're told to do.
Well, this is the legacy, of course, of all conspiratorial governments, whether they're communist, national socialist, Nazi, or Western democracies trying to create conflict with the intent of forging a new world order. I know that these stories that we've recounted tonight are not pleasant to read. These are realities that are part of the core curriculum of life that we must share with others so that the West does not continue down the road of blind optimism and the foolish hope that our leaders are benign and that they only intend to do what they say. I mean, Hitler kept telling his people that I have only benevolent intentions. And he did not have benevolent intentions. He had satanic connections as well and was led by Satan. I think the same thing is true of Stalin and the purges of the Chinese communists, but we are also learning that our own leaders in the West, Churchill and Roosevelt, had these connections and to this satanic globalist agenda and are covertly attempting to undermine U.S. sovereignty, put us into a global new world order.
Well, of course, we know that Winston Churchill, contrary to the image that most people have, was deeply involved in the occult himself. He was a druid. He was a mason. And I had an opportunity of spending some time with General Wedemeyer. I don't know if you ever knew Albert Wedemeyer, but
I didn't, but I know of him. Of course, I read about his dramatic defense of what's right.
And he told me that I spent a couple of weekends with him, and we just were together full time. One of the great times of my life, because he was the man, the officer who was epitomized in that story, The Winds of War, the Horman books, The Winds of War, the officer who used to go to the White House and have dinner with Roosevelt and Churchill. Well, that was actually Al Wedemeyer in real life. And he tells about, of course, during the Second World War, when he wanted to invade Europe, they were ready to invade Europe. They had all the equipment that they needed to invade Europe, and Churchill insists on invading North Africa. There's no reason to invade North Africa. It's a stupid thing. Why not go after the source of this? But Churchill, of course, insists on invading North Africa, insists on invading Italy, so you have to fight up this long, narrow peninsula, and they lose more men at Anzio than they lost. MacArthur lost in all the invasions of the South Pacific. It was just simply like a great garbage disposal, grinding up human lives. And then you go back to the First World War, and you find the story of Gallipoli. No reason for Gallipoli. 140,000 British fell, 140,000 Turks fell in a stupid operation that never could have accomplished anything. Was totally militarily unsound. The military told him, but of course Churchill was the High Lord of the Admiralty. And then you begin to understand what this was really all about. Unless there's an awful lot of death and destruction and horror, the American people will never go into the New World Order, the New World Religion. And you begin to see Churchill in an entirely different light after spending time with General Wedemeyer. And eventually, Churchill forced Wedemeyer out of his position as chief planner for the U.S. military and had him sent off to India, where he was to be an assistant to Mountbatten. Of course, that eventually led his to transfer to China, where he took over command of all the forces there. It was the best thing ever happened because, of course, he became a four-star general there, supervising all military in China during the Second World War. But you get an entirely different picture of Churchill. And the interesting thing was General Wedemeyer wrote a book called Wedemeyer Reports, which was very, very critical of Winston Churchill. And although it was in fourth or fifth or sixth printing here in the United States, they would never allow it to be printed in England. So much for freedom of the press.
Yes, England, it's very interesting. I highly recommend David Irving's three-volume Churchill series. It's dramatic, the picture that he shows of what Churchill was like. I mean, he had some impure, you know, sexual habits and ways of inconveniencing people that were just showed the crudity of a person who was obviously in chronic violation of his conscience. He would often have prayed about naked among staff and other people while he was dictating letters and other things, subjected to that. American military officials hated to be invited to dinner with Churchill because he would always require that they stay up till 3 and 4 hours in the morning. You know, military people had to get up early the next day and simply became less effective when they had to be subjected to the drinking bouts. He was a drunk and a terrible tactician. They just bemoaned the fact whenever Hitler would start to run the military game and overrule his military advisors, because he killed a lot of people in not only Gallipoli, but his Norwegian operation, which was a failed operation, the convoys he kept shipping to Stalin, which were losing almost 50% of the ships going through the North Sea. It was just incredible, the stupid things that he foisted upon his military. He was also kind of a sap for Stalin. Roosevelt was even worse, calling Uncle Joe his friend, would give him virtually anything. But in late September of, I think, 1942, Churchill traveled to Moscow to meet and please the ogre, as his staff called Joseph Stalin. Churchill displeased Stalin initially in his first meeting by declining to agree to mount a 1942 cross-channel invasion. Stalin wanted it, of course, to force Germany to pull forces back from the Russian front to defend the Western front. It would be too costly, Churchill said, in terms of troop losses. Stalin derided Churchill for not being ruthless enough in war. The old ogre, as the British staff called him, thought nothing of losing 10,000 men a day. Churchill warmed to the idea as he began to drink and began, according to his staff, boasting of his ongoing campaign to target German civilians with air raids. According to Roosevelt's man on the scene, Averell Harriman, who was, you know, a co-conspirator with Roosevelt, between the two of them, and I'm quoting Harriman, Stalin and Churchill soon destroyed in their imaginations most of the important industrial cities in Germany. Then, speaking of destroying German civilian morale through residential bombing, Churchill boasted that we will seek no mercy and we will show no mercy. Stalin agreed readily, that is the only way. So much for Churchill, you know, being the great savior of Western civilization.
Well, he was a brilliant individual. He had a quick wit. He had beautiful writing. And if you've read it, I'm sure you've read, Churchill has written, you get one picture. But if you know and talk to people who really knew him, you get an entirely different picture of a wicked little man.
Yes, he really was something Eisenhower never got along with. Churchill was bothered by his habits. He kept it to himself, of course. Eisenhower was a man owned by the establishment, and he bended his will to, you know, ever more evil deeds because he was going to be rewarded, and he was rewarded with the presidency at one time.
Well, you do what you're told, and any one of us could be president. Well, maybe you and I couldn't. We wouldn't have the qualifications, but I fear to look at a man like Gerald Ford. He was rewarded for his treachery on the Warren Commission by becoming vice president, when it was very obvious that the vice president was going to become the president of the United States when they got rid of Richard Nixon. Of course, the job was supposed to have gone to Nelson Rockefeller, but Richard Nixon, I think, realized that all he had to do was appoint Nelson Rockefeller vice president after they got rid of Spiro Agnew on some trumped up charges, and then of course Nelson Rockefeller would be one heartbeat away from the presidency. I think Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford to ensure that he would not become a victim of an assassination or something else. Well, anyway, of course he was forced out. Gerald Ford became the president. And how anybody of that caliber could become the president is rather frightening.
Certainly is. But look what we've got now.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we have a script reader for our president.
Well, and he doesn't even really read the scripts very well.
Well, a lot of people say that, he's really good, but I just, I think he's laughable, frankly. He simply is a Johnny One Note. He puts on his tough face and he growls at the audience and he doesn't, have any other speech.
Well, the tragedy is when he has to put on a press conference, those things are all staged. And if you watch the press conference, the last one I saw was just before, I think, we attacked Afghanistan. And, he had a script there. He read the script. And then he looks down at his podium and he says, well, let's go to the reporters. Bill, do you have a question? Then he looks up and Bill jumps up. And Bill has a little notepad in his hand. He's got all the question there. And then after he reads the question off the notepad, the president looks down at the podium, sees what he's supposed to answer. He gives that answer, and then he looks up, and he smiles, and then he looks down, and then he says, Charlie, do you have a question? And then Charlie jumps up, and then, of course, he looks at Charlie. It was all scripted. It was so embarrassing to realize that he's incapable of putting on a press conference.
Yes, it was scripted who he was to call upon, and
right.
That was... the fact that journalists refuse to blow the whistle on that indicates, what a prostituted profession they've become.
Well, if you want to keep going to the White House, well, you've got to play the game.
Apparently so.
All right, fine. Well, what else do we go on to now? Of course, you've done a beautiful job talking about Tyler Kent and Caton Forest and bombing civilians, Operation Keelhaub, and then other losses, which are really very devastating stories, which everybody should be aware of, but unfortunately they're not, because of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think.
Well, I do have some other fresh topics that are coming out in tomorrow's World Affairs Brief. We might want to let your audience know if we have any callers who would like to ask me questions or comment about what we've talked about so far, which...
All right, fine.
Open to that as well.
We'll open up the lines if anybody would like to call here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're sitting out there in the audience and you've never heard these things before, we do have a little packet on Operation Keelhaub with excerpts from the three books I talked about, and we do have that video available through Radio Liberty on simply Operation Keelhaub, one of the most devastating stories ever told. It's it's third or fourth generation copy, but the sound is good, and the story, well, it's a story every American should know. Mainly not because it's important, mainly because everybody's heard of the 6 million Jews who died in the concentration camps in Europe. But what about the 6 million people who perished with Operation Keelhaub? How could they possibly cover that up unless they have total control over the media in the United States, over the educational facilities, really over what the American people think? Well, let's go on to the next item here. We have somebody calling in, and maybe there'll be some more people after we go to the break.
Well, I'd like to comment on the almost total sellout of Taiwan. At least it's almost a done deal now. This week we saw the confrontation over Taiwan's independence. It seemed to end with all parties, including there was Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao, who visited President Bush. President of Taiwan Chen Shui-bian has never been invited, of course, there. But I guess we can talk about that after the break.
Well, I think that what you're going to say is that George Bush has told the Taiwanese, do not hold an election on independence from China. Don't you dare do that. Now, up to this time, we've never really let people know, China know how we felt, but what we've in essence said is that if you try to be independent from China, why, we will not defend you. The one thing that I think has kept China from invading Taiwan was not knowing what America would do. I think Bush has telegraphed a very, very clear message why we give you control over these poor, helpless people because we wouldn't want to do anything to disturb our good friends of the Chinese murderers. We'll be right back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And if you'd like to know more about his organization and how you can get his information, the telephone number is 801-224-4746. That's 801-224-4746. So why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there? You were talking about Taiwan and the president's the really almost ultimatum to the people on Taiwan, telling them not to hold an election on independence from China. Is that pretty much what's going on?
Yes, let alone declare independence. You know, the Taiwanese people are the only ones who don't yet know that this is a done deal, a sellout of Taiwanese independence. It's a tragic progression, Dr. Stan, of secret talks that began with the Kissinger promises to China at the end of the Vietnam War. We just found that out about 3 years ago, that part of the secret talks with China on ending the Vietnam War was a commitment that the U.S. would never support Taiwanese independence. Now, I think this is the supreme hypocrisy for a nation that is supposed to champion the right of people to self-determination. We overthrew Saddam Hussein in the name of self-determination and democracy of its oppressed people. What could be more tragic than betraying the Taiwanese to Red China with its brutal system of prison camps, the Lao Gai, similar to the Russian gulags, and that make Saddam's crimes, frankly, look mild by comparison? In point of fact, President Chen was not present, of course, at the sellout talks between Premier Nguyen and President Bush. Taiwan, despite being a faithful trading partner since World War II, is not recognized by the U.S., has no embassy, and has refused access to the White House. The Chinese communists in opposition, who openly avow eventual conflict with the U.S., are granted full diplomatic recognition. They have military exchanges. They have preference in visiting all secret U.S. military facilities, including New Mexico and Lawrence Livermore Laboratories in California. I mean, it's incredible. You and I couldn't get a pass to go in there, but communist and Soviet officials get visiting privileges all the time to Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore. They also get access to use aircraft, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, all of their secret production facilities. Premier Nguyen of China was given full military honors this week as he met with President Bush, including a 21-gun salute, a state dinner, and every diplomatic praise and courtesy President Bush could bestow. I find this tragic in its significance.
But really, at least they're consistent. You know, I remember when we had Tiananmen Square, and they go say, here are these people holding these banners of Statue of Liberty and pictures of Abraham Lincoln, and these Chinese people, they just want to be free. And, of course, they're run over by the tank, they killed 10,000 of them. And you would think that the American president at least might say, you shouldn't have done that, or break diplomatic relations. Instead of that, George Herbert Walker Bush pushed for the most favored nation treaty status with communist China. So why should we be surprised what his son would do essentially the same thing? Because behind everything that's going on, there are other forces the American people don't know about. I think there are all sorts of secret agreements between the people who rule the world, because I think they all have a common source of power. I believe that, as it says in the good book, why the evil one rules the nations of this world, or words to that effect. So,
my take on that, though, Stan, is I really don't think that they are mutually aware that they're working for the same satanic team. In other words,
I don't think they are either.
Satan has promised each of these conspiring predator nations, Russia, China, and the U.S. Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-American globalists, each one of them have promised world hegemony and power and promises of immunity and the other things that Satan promises but cannot deliver. And each of them believes that they're going to be supreme. Now, obviously, I think that Satan tends to sacrifice Russia next in the battle against to promote global hegemony and this destruction of American liberty and religious liberty, I think, which is what Satan is ultimately afterwards, as well as killing off millions of people, destroying the works of God, he thinks. And I think the next conflict after Russia's gone in World War III, the next Cold War will be between China and the West. You know, the West and their globalist structures always need to have a boogeyman to fight against, always have to have a created enemy in order to justify continued military dominance and the denial of national sovereignty. And this we see being played out in Taiwan. I think very strongly that the Chinese would never invade Taiwan prior to 2008. They may never have to do it. I mean, they certainly want to play up to the Olympic games that they've been awarded by this very corrupt International Olympic Organization, which has always been favorable to tyrannies and promoting the communist agendas, whether it's in, when they held the games in Yugoslavia and praised the Yugoslavian communists, whether they held them in Moscow or Berlin and Munich, Munich in 1936. Olympics organization is a shameful organization in my estimation. But nevertheless, I think that China wants to really take advantage of the propaganda value of that. And the U.S. Agreeing now, and here's Bush's words about after he had met with Nguyen. He had said, and I can find a quote here, Well, even before Nguyen's visit, I might say that Washington sent an official representative to Taipei to tell Chen not to hold a sovereignty-related referendum, just as they had demanded Chen not do in March when he was going to hold a referendum. I know it sounds similar, but Vice President Chen Shui-bian of Taiwan isn't even intending to put the referendum issue in terms of Taiwanese independence. The Chinese lobbied very hard in the Taiwanese parliament, scared a lot of people with their threats, and they watered down and limited the referendum law so that it could not cover anything about Chinese independence. And yet still, Prime Minister or Premier Nguyen from China is insisting that Bush go further and make sure that he tell Taiwan in no uncertain terms that they aren't to destabilize the status quo. And that's exactly what Bush said. He said, "Any unilateral decision by either China or Taiwan to change the status quo is forbidden, and the comments and action made by the leader of Taiwan indicate that he may be willing to make decisions unilaterally to change the status quo," referring to the referendum, "which we oppose." Now, while the Bush administration continued to reiterate, at least rhetorically, that they would oppose any use of force by China to reunite with Taiwan, it's obvious from the current tactic of what one official at the White House said, strategic ambiguity is what they're proposing, that the U.S. wants Taiwan to be absorbed peacefully. Now, of course, Dr. Stan, as you know, losing liberty slowly or through force ends up at the same tragic ending, death and imprisonment for millions of Taiwanese that will later resist, the Chinese domination. Interestingly enough, even in Hong Kong, the Chinese have been slowly tightening the screws, but they're slow enough that even Hong Kong people who visit have told me, look, the Chinese haven't been so bad, it hasn't been what we thought it would be, and the Taiwanese are being induced into thinking that maybe we can survive too by giving in to China. But I think as history will tell, and people are very short-sighted in their memories, they don't realize that as soon as the sugar attracts people into the trap and the trap is closed, the purges begin. They always begin. Communists cannot tolerate even the thought that you have people with the liberty to think anti-communist thoughts. They want them all dead. And people have got to remember that's the heritage of communists, and they've never deviated from that. And that's because there's true evil there behind it. And it's a satanic, conspiracy, and they want people dead.
All right, well, you won't get any argument at all from us on this end. And I feel sorry for the people in Taiwan. They're very prosperous at the present time, and they have a vibrant economy. They you know, they're so much more protective than Communist China has been, although Communist China is coming up, becoming more productive. In fact, it's very interesting. Apparently, they're beginning to run out of electricity. They aren't generating enough electricity for all the new industries that are being created there with our tax money. American government is financing, encouraging our industry to move there, subsidizing them through the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the Export Impact Bank, and also those other vehicles to get American corporations to leave the United States and go over there, and then we penalize them if they bring their money back to the United States, so they have more of an incentive to keep their money out of the United States and build up the economies of the rest of the world rather than come back in America and build jobs.
The same thing is actually happening in Taiwan. Before I get to the story of Taiwanese jobs going to the mainland, let me also point out, relative to electricity in China, that China is the largest polluter now of coal-powered electric generating plants. That's what they're primarily using, the largest, highest number of coal-fired electric generating facilities. And they have no pollution controls on them whatsoever. Yet we don't hear the leftist environmental lobby complaining about China, only about the United States, which has a great deal of pollution control. Power plants are relatively clean burning here.
Hey, where's Al Gore when we need him?
That's right. But relative to Taiwan, it's very interesting. I think we have a situation in Taiwan where President Chen Shui-bian there is really a phony conservative, just as we're facing a phony conservative in Bush. He campaigns on the independence issue. The Nationalist Party, you know, used to be on independence, but they've always stuck to this one China policy, meaning we are China. The one China policy of the Nationalist Party is now morphed into one China, but it's really over there now, and we will eventually have to succumb. That's why the Nationalist Party lost to President Chen over the last two elections, because the majority of Taiwanese don't want to submit to mainland Chinese domination. But I think that Chen has shown that he is following a secret agenda to slow down this fervor for independence, to draw it out. That's why he didn't fight back against this watering down and limiting of the referendum bill. He began to champion it, saying he could live within its provisions. He hasn't even attempted this particular time around to boast a referendum. He could have found some wiggle room in the language to put independence on the ballot, but he refused to do so. He was only attempting to have a referendum on whether or not the Taiwanese people protest the 465 missile systems the Chinese has opposite them on the Straits of Taiwan. I mean, that's like, are you against motherhood and apple pie? It's a stupid referendum. Everyone knows that everyone's against the missile systems over there. But what's happening is that Chen is under the table encouraging a great deal of businesses and companies to move jobs overseas to mainland Taiwan. They have to do this economically, as any country that raises its wage rate. It happened in Japan, the first of the cheap markets for the United States, and then Japanese labor got up so high-priced that the cheap market for production moved to Taiwan, and then Taiwan and Korea have slowly raised their labor rates, and that's why it's going to China now. So for Taiwan to compete now and maintain its contracts for production, they have to start subletting their labor to and having manufacturing being done in China and then sell it through Taiwan in order to maintain their sales. Now, the more that happens, the more local Taiwanese businessmen are going to be induced to be against independence, because it will threaten their cross-border relationships with China. So trade is used as a two-way sword. Libertarians think that trade is going to moderate China, but it really doesn't work that way. China is only using trade in order to prepare to kill and strike out against the West. But slowly trade does destroy the motive to resist the dragon of China, both in American terms and Taiwanese terms. It makes us dependent on their cheap goods.
And we are increasingly dependent on their goods. In fact, as we do away with our industrial base, where are we going to get our products if it's not from our friends over in China?
Well, while it's true that many of the things that we're being purchased over there are not really of essential nature, we are, in fact, losing essential goods. I mean, we couldn't even be hard-pressed to outfit an army with boots and clothing because our textile industry is almost completely destroyed, as well as the shoemaking industry here in the United States.
But even more than that, many of the parts to us, many of our, you know, complicated missiles and the
electronics,
right,
yes.
You know, they're all manufactured in China. So if we're going to have a war with China, why, we couldn't possibly put together our electronic gadgets because we'd have to get them from communist China. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. And yet this is exactly what's happening today. And the average American is totally unaware of what's transpiring.
Well, certainly over time, the Americans could gear up again for these, manufacturing, but there would be a time lag of at least a year to gear up for production. And that won't happen if my scenario is correct, that the Russians are planning, along with the Chinese, a preemptive nuclear strike in the United States. We'll be down for at least a couple of years before we'll be able to get back up to a third world level again.
But at least you're going to give us till after 2008 for that preemptive nuclear strike.
I do. I have pushed back my estimate of when the Russians and Chinese will strike till the latter part of this decade, at least after 2008, because of this major propaganda ploy of 2008, which the Chinese will. So we have breathing room. We have breathing room to prepare. But I'm very concerned that conservatives are failing to prepare because they continue to have confidence that President Bush will save them. And I think the evidence indicates that this man is working not for American interests, but for global interests.
Well, I think that you're right, and I think that the great tragedy is that the American people are not allowed really to question what's going on today. In fact, I interviewed a very, very prominent man I considered part of the establishment yesterday on one of my programs, and he was saying how terrible it was that people would criticize the president when we were at war. As if somehow you're being, unfaithful to the American troops to criticize the president, who got us into this stupid war.
So how do you handle a situation? Certainly you couldn't have let that remark stand without some comment.
Well, I didn't challenge him. If I'd challenged him, we wouldn't have gotten very far at all. I wanted to hear what he had to say.
Uh-huh.
His name was Colonel Oliver North.
Oh, really? Well, you really did have an establishment hack on your show.
I really did. But it was an interesting time. In fact, his book is really, it's called War Stories. Fascinating. He starts out by saying, all these terrible people criticizing George Bush simply because he landed that plane on the deck of the aircraft.
And he didn't land the plane.
Of course, you know that. And I didn't. But if you read that book, the inference is he landed the plane. He may have been wearing a uniform, a flight suit. He may have even been sitting in the cockpit. But nobody other than a naval pilot would ever be allowed to land the plane there. And yet he was so critical of these people who said this was a photo op. And he's saying, here, the president lands the plane on the carrier deck, and you've got people like Senator Byrd criticizing him, and how terrible it is, these people, they just, all they want to do is criticize the president and, in time of war and demoralize our troops.
You know, one of the interesting things, I got a blurb from a very pro-Bush Republican committee trying to, they had a big 8x10 photo of the president walking away from this Viking aircraft that he flew into the aircraft carrier on, and the yellow jackets and the blue shirts there are giving him a salute, and they're saying, you have this autographed portrait of President Bush in this sterling moment, and they went on about the liberals trying to discredit his landing on the carrier. They failed to realize these people didn't have enough savvy to see that right there in the middle of the photo is a yellow shirt, which is one of the deckhanders, giving the president a left-handed salute with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. not having enough military savvy to realize this deckhandler was insulting the president of the United States, and they published that whole photo to the world without realizing it.
Well, I think the tragedy is that so much of this is just is showbiz. Now, I think he's a masterful showman. I don't really think he thinks these things.
Well, his handlers are masterful.
His handlers are, and I think going over for Thanksgiving, the surprise visit to the troops over in Iraq was a masterful thing. But it's all showbiz, and people have to understand that. And after all, Hillary was over in Afghanistan. George couldn't let Hillary get the best of him.
Interesting, going back to the aircraft situation, the reason the sailors were really upset, and what the people in this little blurb defending the president didn't tell their audience was that, yes, they were 3 miles offshore, but that they had actually been entering the Bay of San Diego and had to turn around and go back out to 30 miles offshore. They had to go back out to prepare for this show for the president landing. So in other words, he delayed their entrance back to their families who were waiting for their arrival by a day and a half.
No, I hadn't heard that story.
So that's why they were angry. This was not, you know, a lot of them obviously were supported. They had the honor of having the president fly in, but a lot of them were angry because their wives and children were there waiting and had to go home and come back another day because they got turned around.
Well, so much of what we see is perception. You know, we often start our programs, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And with everything going on, it's perception, and of course we see, you know, so many people tell us that the president, you know, starts his day on his knees praying and looks to God for constant guidance on what he should be doing next. And it really sounds good. But I really wish he would, of course, renounce his membership in the Skull and Bone Society. I wish he'd get rid of the evil people who surround him. And I wish he'd be quite forthright with the American people about what really led up to the 9/11 attack. And simply release all these records that they're keeping secret. Because if they have nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? And why won't they turn that information over to his own hand-picked investigating committee?
Well, that's quite a wish list you've got there, Dr. Stan. I don't have much confidence that that's ever going to happen.
I don't either, but we ask the questions hoping that at least some of the people out there in the listening audience will ask the same question, and maybe they'll say, gee, maybe things are not as they appear to be. Maybe, of course, we are being lied to by the media. Maybe everything we are seeing is simply alteration or control of our perception. And I think that this is really what it's all about. These people are masterful in being able to manipulate how we respond, how we feel, what we think.
It's amazing what happens, scandal after scandal, how the media covers it up. It's just been announced that Halliburton had built the U.S. government over $61 million for excess charges of gasoline in Iraq. They were $67 million trying to overcharge the government for cafeteria services. This is Kellogg and Brown and Root, subsidiary of Halliburton. And so what's the penalty? Halliburton just was announced to get another $1 billion worth of construction contracts in, without a bid, even after the president had pledged that all future contracts would require competitive bidding. Remember, he did that about a month ago. And now we have another no-bid contract awarded to who? Halliburton, the one who's should be rejected out of hand for having built the government on millions of dollars.
You know, it was really very interesting last night on the news. They just had a little brief quip. They had Dick Cheney walking across the stage to a podium, and they said the vice president's used to work for Halliburton, and Halliburton just got this great contract, and they're making 26 cents profit on every gallon of gasoline they bring on into Iraq. That's all they said. But the inference was there, and I thought, obviously there's somebody there that's trying to get the truth out to the American people. And, of course, it should be pretty obvious that Dick Cheney, still has some sort of relationship with Halliburton. In fact, I've read that he still gets a $100,000 a year delayed contract from Halliburton for covering the time when he did work with him in the past. But I'm sure that in no way has any influence at all on these lucrative no-bid contracts that Halliburton's getting today. You know, eventually the American people are going to wake up to this, I would think. I just hope it's not too late.
What they don't realize is that it goes beyond Cheney's personal relationship. Halliburton has long been, like Bechtel, a hand in the glove of government, and it just happens to be one of the ways in which insider-connected government corporations are able to reward political personalities who are part of what I believe is the dark side of government.
Well, do you think that Halliburton and Bechtel already have ties into the CIA, into the intelligence agencies?
Well, no, not in so many words, other than the fact that they both work for the same dark side controllers who operate. The CIA is the enforcement arm.
All right.
And Halliburton and other corporations are the rewarding arm. There are insurance companies. There's a whole slew of companies in Denver, Colorado, Seattle. All the major cities have major corporations, so that bad boy FBI agents, when they get exposed, they go to work at six figures for an insurance company, and they just sit at a desk and don't even have to show up to work. They get to work for all that money for 2 years before their name clears and they're able to go back to the FBI and do their thing again. I mean, this is the kind of insider revolving door relationships that happens all the time. We now know about Condit, resigning from the from Boeing, and he had relationship with several women that are scandalous of Clinton proportions, as well as insider dealings with a Pentagon supposed contracting officer that was supposed to be scrutinizing Boeing, was in fact representing Boeing to the Pentagon.
And she went to work for Boeing after negotiating the lucrative contract for Boeing.
And just had to be fired recently when that was made public. But this is an incestuous relationship that, Condit nearly bankrupted Boeing going into the military contracting business and buying Donnell Douglas and buying out the competition. But he knew what he was doing because he had guaranteed promises from his government insiders that they would give him sufficient military contracts to make that look good. And it has become the biggest money-making aspect of Boeing Corporation, the military contracting business.
Well, I thought that was really so interesting that the Air Force wanted to lease these tanker planes rather than buy them. And, after 4 or 5 years, or maybe 10 years, why, then have the full price of the money, of the cost of the planes, and then Boeing would still own the planes. It would mean, talk about a sweetheart deal, or incest. This would give incest a bad name. And yet, of course, nobody really being punished in either side for it. Condit maybe have been forced to resign, but I mean, this is criminal activity. You're talking about, $10 or $20 billion that they were going to fleece the American taxpayers out of.
What most people don't realize, though, at all these excess high costs for contracting and all the major four or five industrial military contractors is to cover for black budget projects. It's no longer $300 hammers. It's an extra billion here and there on a large contract. You look at the numbers being thrown at these contracts in Iraq, and they're not only no-bid contracts, but they were given contracts for oil rebuilding when the war hadn't even started yet. Now, how do you bid on something that hasn't happened yet? This is obviously hiding other giveaway of funds that for other purposes.
You think this is to finance CIA operations or to
not
buy
just, No, CIA operations are mostly financed by illicit drug profits. These are for black budget secret military weapon systems that are being designed not to defend America, but I think to eventually defeat Russia after they do this anticipated strike on America, this nuclear preemptive strike that will lead to World War III. I think the secret black budget weapons are the secret weapon that will turn the tide in the New World Order favor. The U.S. will claim to be down for the count, but will give the secret black budget weapons, I believe, over to control of the U.N. Forces fighting Russia so that we will be able to defeat her after disarming as we have been over these years.
Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners tonight, Joel?
Well, it's been a long program. I admire you a great deal, Stan, for your ability to fight this great battle and do it for such long hours. I wish you Godspeed and happy holidays, that you might have some rest and be rejuvenated for this coming year.
Well, we've got a lot of exciting things going to be happening, and I'm looking forward to having you as a frequent guest on our program, because you do bring so much variety and so much great information to our listeners, and I know many of them call or write and tell us how much they enjoy what you have to say. So thanks so very much, Joel, and if I don't see you or talk to you beforehand, well, you have a wonderful and glorious Christmas time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest has been Joel Skousen, and I hope you've enjoyed it, as we always do. So this is the time we ask you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but to pray for revival as well, because we're involved in a spiritual battle for the hearts and souls of mankind and the survival of Western civilization. So please also pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Stand with us until tomorrow, when we'll be back once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.